That's the World Saxophone Quartet with Tutu, a tribute to Miles Davis. Of course, you know Miles Davis was very famous for that particular tune dedicated to Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa. That's from their 1998 album, Selim Savad, meaning Seven Steps to Heaven. Hamid Blewett on baritone sax, Dave Murray on tenor, Oliver Lake, alto, and John Purcell on flute, Jack DeJohnette on drums, Chief Bey, Onyerima Asante, and Titos Sompa on African percussion. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, March the 27th, and we will continue with our media literacy theme from yesterday. So when the phones open up, you will feel free to pick up that topic. But it continues with none other than our president. Yes, yes, yes. The president is cutting a wide swath through Europe, urging European Union and North Atlantic Treaty Organization allies, that's NATO, to stand fast in unity against Russia's military aggression against Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea. Actions, he says, that are grave violations of world order. He spoke yesterday at The Hague in Brussels and warned that Europe will experience past calamities all over again if its leaders do not move quickly to check Russia's desire to expand its empire. What is interesting is the speech itself. Now, our media literacy job today is to listen. I'm just excerpting probably about one-third of the speech. It's about 36 minutes long, a little too long for us to hear in its entirety today. But I want you to listen to the speech at its beginning and what the president says. When we open up the phones right after that, I would like you, in the sense of your media literacy skills, to analyze what we have just heard, okay? So that's the task today, our media literacy. You know how we do this. You listen to the speech. You listen to what's said, but you also listen to what is not said. You take into consideration the environment of the speech, and all of that should inform you as to what you make of the speech. The intent, of course, I just said to you, is to call the EU nations and the NATO nations to get it together, stand as one firmly against Vladimir Putin and his country. So let's hear the wonderful speech as it started out yesterday.
Mr. Prime Minister and the people of Belgium, on behalf of the American people, we are grateful for your friendship. We stand together as inseparable allies, and I thank you for your wonderful hospitality. I have to admit, it is easy to love a country famous for chocolate and beer. Leaders and dignitaries of the European Union, representatives of our NATO alliance, distinguished guests, we meet here at a moment of testing for Europe and the United States, and for the international order that we have worked for generations to build. Throughout human history, societies have grappled with fundamental questions of how to organize themselves, the proper relationship between the individual and the state, the best means to resolve inevitable conflicts between states. And it was here in Europe, through centuries of struggle, through war and enlightenment, repression and revolution, that a particular set of ideals began to emerge. The belief that through conscience and free will, each of us has the right to live as we choose, The belief that power is derived from the consent of the governed, and that laws and institutions should be established to protect that understanding. And those ideas eventually inspired a band of colonialists across an ocean, and they wrote them into the founding documents that still guide America today, including the simple truth that all men and women are created equal. But those ideals have also been tested here in Europe and around the world. Those ideals have often been threatened by an older, more traditional view of power. This alternative vision argues that ordinary men and women are too small-minded to govern their own affairs, that order and progress can only come when individuals surrender their rights to an all-powerful sovereign. Often, this alternative vision roots itself in the notion that by virtue of race or faith or ethnicity, some are inherently superior to others, and that individual identity must be defined by us versus them, or that national greatness must flow not by what people stand for, but what they are against. In so many ways, the history of Europe in the 20th century represented the ongoing clash of these two sets of ideas, both within nations and among nations. The advance of industry and technology outpaced our ability to resolve our differences peacefully. And even among the most civilized of societies on the surface, we saw a descent into barbarism. This morning at Flanders Field, I was reminded of how war between peoples sent a generation to their deaths in the trenches and gas of the First World War. And just two decades later, extreme nationalism plunged this continent into war once again, with populations enslaved and great cities reduced to rubble, and tens of millions slaughtered, including those lost in the Holocaust. It is in response to this tragic history that in the aftermath of World War II, America joined with Europe to reject the darker forces of the past and build a new architecture of peace. Workers and engineers gave life to the Marshall Plan. Sentinels stood vigilant in a NATO alliance that would become the strongest the world has ever known. And across the Atlantic, we embraced a shared vision of Europe, a vision based on representative democracy, individual rights, and a belief that nations can meet the interests of their citizens through trade and open markets, a social safety net, respect for those of different faiths and backgrounds. For decades, this vision stood in sharp contrast to life on the other side of an Iron Curtain. For decades, a contest was waged. And ultimately, that contest was won, not by tanks or missiles, but because our ideals stirred the hearts of Hungarians who sparked a revolution, Poles in their shipyards who stood in solidarity, Czechs who waged a velvet revolution without firing a shot, and East Berliners who marched past the guards and finally tore down that wall. Today, what would have seemed impossible in the trenches of Flanders, the rubble of Berlin, a dissident's prison cell, that reality is taken for granted. A Germany unified, the nations of Central and Eastern Europe welcomed into the family of democracies. Here in this country, once the battleground of Europe, we meet in the hub of a union that brings together age-old adversaries in peace and cooperation. The people of Europe, hundreds of millions of citizens, east, west, north, south, are more secure and more prosperous because we stood together for the ideals we share. And this story of human progress was by no means limited to Europe. Indeed, the ideals that came to define our alliance also inspired movements across the globe. Among those very people, ironically, who had too often been denied their full rights by Western powers. After the Second World War, people from Africa to India threw off the yoke of colonialism to secure their independence. In the United States, citizens took freedom rides and endured beatings to put an end to segregation and to secure their civil rights. As the Iron Curtain fell here in Europe, the iron fist of apartheid was unclenched, and Nelson Mandela emerged upright, proud, from prison to lead a multiracial democracy. Latin American nations rejected dictatorship and built new democracies, and Asian nations showed that development and democracy could go hand in hand. The young people in the audience today, young people like Laura, were born in a place and a time where there is less conflict, more prosperity, and more freedom than any time in human history. But that's not because man's darkest impulses have vanished. Even here in Europe, we've seen ethnic cleansing in the Balkans that shocked the conscience. The difficulties of integration and globalization, recently amplified by the worst economic crisis of our lifetimes, strained the European project and stirred the rise of a politics that too often targets immigrants or gays or those who seem somehow different. While technology has opened up vast opportunities for trade and innovation and cultural understanding, it's also allowed terrorists to kill on a horrifying scale. Around the world, sectarian warfare and ethnic conflicts continue to claim thousands of lives. And once again, we are confronted with the belief among some that bigger nations can bully smaller ones to get their way. That recycled maxim that might somehow makes right. So I come here today to insist that we must never take for granted the progress that has been won here in Europe and advanced around the world. Because the contest of ideas continues for your generation. And that's what's at stake in Ukraine today.
All right. Well, you heard it. There we are. So, as this president was speaking and your very, very keen ears were picking up everything he said, something might have occurred to you about this speech so far. And this is just the beginning. There's a lot more of this. But there was a lot that he said in the beginning because he set it up about this noble idea of freedom and democracy and all of that stuff. But I'm looking to you to tell me what he said and what was most significant about what he said. 888-874-4888. We're not going to waste any time on this stuff today. We're moving lightning speed because we know what the deal is here. This speech was quite interesting. In the way he set it up, because I will give you a hint, lots and lots and lots of irony. Yes. 888-874-4888. What did the president's speech mean to you? What was significant about what he said so far? Just in the setup alone, you know where the speech is going. And I'm interested in how it resonated with you. 888-874-4888. I tell you, when I listened to this, I said, my gosh, is there no shame? Is there no shame left, really? You're going to go to Europe and completely revise history. All right. Let's hear what you have to say. 888-874-4888. In the second half of our program today, while I wait for your calls, we'll be going to Detroit. A major fight is brewing in the courts for April 1st. People are getting together their legal complaints and lawsuits to present them to the judge on April the 1st. We'll get an update on that struggle in Detroit. That's a critical point in the struggle in Detroit over the issue of bankruptcy. All right. So who's up first? Okay. Mike from Michigan, you're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
What I get from the speech is, though, he's over in another nation, and the whole United States, in my opinion, is just going total to hell. I don't know if that's what you were looking for, but I drive in Detroit every day, and these people have less and less and less.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are bragging about the people are their own cops, and taking out the guns and shooting when they want to now. So, you know, it's just totally pathetic. And this man is going to go down in the history books, in my opinion, as one of the worst we ever had in mankind.
Wow.
I don't know if that you would look
that's
like
quite
that.
An indictment there, Mike. But okay, I respect your opinion. Thank you so much for getting us started today. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. 888-874-4888. What was significant about the portion of the speech that you've heard so far, based on what you know? From Dallas, you're on the air, Sarah.
Greetings to you, Therese.
Thank you. You too.
Therese, what I heard at the beginning of his speech when he made that little flippant joke about Belgium and chocolates and beer, it brought me back to mind to what Belgium doesn't have any chocolate farms. They import their chocolate from the African continent. Especially what happened.
You know, you I don't know how you was that talented. You were reading my notes, and I wish you would stop doing that.
I'm clairvoyant.
I wrote, well, not one cocoa tree grows in Belgium.
Anywhere in Europe. But he's going to make a flippant comment about chocolate, King Leopold, and what he did in the Congo with cutting, chopping off hands and legs of the natives, people who were not working fast enough or were accused of stealing their own resources. That really got my goat going.
That did it for me too, believe it or not. When he said that, I said, this man, whoever his speechwriter is, it's clear that he doesn't have a reference point about saying Belgium being famous for its chocolates, how did it get the chocolate?
Exactly.
Okay.
Colonialism.
By brute force, by exporting terror to other nations in order to be the world authority and the great producer of fine chocolates. But it came at the deaths of millions of people on the African continent and in the southern United States. I'd say the southern United States. I'm so messed up now. In South America and in the Caribbean. So where is this thing just drove me nuts when I heard it. So I'm glad that you found that too.
Yes, and the other part with him talking about terrorism and making the face of terrorism black and brown people around the world, he's not referring to terrorism as to what Europeans have done, even amongst themselves, because World War I and World War II was European ethnic cleansing of each other. There were people, European, slaughtering each other because they were not considered to be white.
Well, yes, and even when he mentioned, and this is a very, very important fact, if when people speak of the Holocaust, they must remember that Jews were not the only ones who were just wiped off the face of the earth.
They were gypsies.
We had the Roma people who also were killed in the millions, and they're just never mentioned.
But as well as blacks from the African continent, these so-called mixed breed blacks who came from Namibia, other German colonies who were living in Europe, or Americans who were married, or other blacks who were married to Europeans and had these mixed race children, or were black themselves who were also rounded up and killed. It was not just Jews alone. So it's very disingenuous when they always like to talk about Jews and the Holocaust and they leave out all of these others as Catholics and others of other who were also rounded up and also exterminated.
Well, thank you. But I'm you are officially a clairvoyant today, because that's the first thing I wrote. I said, don't you add chocolate? You know, this thing burns me up every time I hear things like that. Thank you so much.
You're
Michael,
welcome, Eutrice.
New Jersey, what do you have to say?
Hi, Eutrice. Am I on the air?
Hi. Yes.
Oh, thanks. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
I just thought that the speech was fraught with paradox and hypocrisy.
Okay.
And I think it was shot through with it. But the major thing that indicates that, in my view, is that in the context of nationalism, he's talking about the problems that nationalism creates in this specific case. But he doesn't say, let's get rid of the problem, nationalism. He said, let's just make sure it goes in our direction.
But Michael, what story in all of the things he was saying, allegedly as instruction to the European audience that he was playing to, who was he really talking about?
Who was he talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's talking specifically about the Russians and
yes,
Ukraine.
But the irony,
he's pointing to that problem.
Irony, the irony of it all.
The irony is that, you know, he's involved in all of the problems, and he says that, you know, we've solved all these problems. In the context he says that there's unprecedented freedom and security, and the next word out of his mouth is we had the worst economic collapse ever. So where's the security and freedom in that?
But when he's talking about the fact that, you know, might makes right, and he's talking about the whole idea of Europeans coming to terms with the ideal that, you know, we should have freedom and democracy and all this other kind of stuff, did it occur to you that he was actually speaking, whether he was conscious of it or not, he was talking about the United States. Everything he said.
Oh, everything going to be applied to our own country, of course, because it's so hypocritical. And it's so paradoxical. Because everything he's saying, he's a perfect example of the problems that are caused, you know, that we have it right here.
Of course.
We have security, but we have no security. We have the safety net, but we're tearing it to pieces. You know, it's one thing after another.
But I love the fact that he was completely oblivious to the fact that he was actually telling an inside joke.
Apparently. Apparently,
he's talking about all these things, these noble ideas that were never realized here back at home. You know, all these things and these dark forces that are running rampant through Europe. Well,
who's he talking about? He really believes that he's talking to, you know, a public that's as dumb as nails.
No.
He thinks we're all sitting home watching the Kardashians.
If you have a chance, I just want you to do this as an exercise. If you have a chance, perhaps C-SPAN has it or somebody has a speech. When they pan to the audience, it is amazing how many members of the audience were propping up their chins with their hands while they were listening to him. And it's a kind of bodily expression that says, this guy can't be saying these things.
That's right. It's either that gesture or you pan to the audience and see everybody with their jaws hanging open in disbelief.
He's talking about, you know, why they shouldn't tolerate this kind of force and whatnot. And it's the history of the United States, aggression toward others. In fact, right now, the whole issue about the United States stoking aggression in Ukraine by supporting neo-Nazis. He's talking about, on the one hand, the pointing out the extermination and the Holocaust of Jews, and on the other hand, he's ignoring the fact that he and his government are really seriously, firmly behind the Nazis who are now on the rise in Ukraine.
Yes,
hysterical.
You know, I've got a new term for all of this in the media and everything. I call it the baloney show.
The baloney show. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
So much for calling. Thanks. Catherine from New York, what have you to say? What are your observations?
Hi, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, there were so many things that stood out. I actually grew up in Europe. I live in New York now. I listen to your show a lot. I think you're one of the best political analysts there are, actually.
Oh, geez. Well,
but,
thank you.
I'm disappointed with Obama. And right before the speech, I was talking with my husband saying, you know, he got the Nobel Peace Prize before he became the war president. Now he's over there talking about all the different wars over there, the big guys pushing the little guys around. But that's what we do all the time. And he's talking about dissident prisons. Well, we have those here now, too. We have dissident journalists that are afraid to speak out. All the news is censored. Well, you know, I'll probably be red flagged for just talking on your show. I mean, that's what it's like now here. You know?
I know what you mean. Yes.
And,
but it did occur to you, as a person growing up in Europe, a person who comes from Europe, if you were in that audience, what would you be thinking?
If I were what?
If you were in the audience, what would you be thinking?
Oh, first of all, well, every time I go back to visit, every Belgian says, we think he's terribly arrogant. And I say, why is that? Well, the way he speaks, the way he looks. I don't think that they understand the English that well, but they think the content is pretty empty. And it's always the talk about democracy and freedom, as you said. Everything is okay. As long as it's in the name of democracy, it's okay to invade any country, to go in, destroy, you know, murder the population in the name of democracy. That's what we're doing.
That's right.
And I mean, every country throughout the world seems to have a bad government right now. And I try to say to myself, maybe our government is the best of all of them. Which one are we supposed to pick out of a bad lot? It's hard to, and how come out of so many millions of people with every election, there's two bad choices? But getting back to the subject of Obama and his speech, when you told me, you know, I could tell by the way you spoke about it was going to be really bad. But when I heard it, I thought, my God, he is rewriting history. And then when he mentioned the Hungarians tearing down a wall, I wasn't familiar with the Hungarians tearing down a wall. Did he mention that?
Well, he talked about the Hungarians basically adopting the instruction from Nelson Mandela, the popular uprising for freedom and democracy.
Yeah, you had to bring in Nelson Mandela, of course.
Well, this is funny because he mentioned Poland, and in fact, Nelson Mandela was the inspiration for Lech Walesa, actually. That's so funny.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I was just telling my husband I'm on your show right now because he listens to you, too.
Thank you so much for calling, Catherine. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll continue to listen. And, of course, now I'm on the black list or red list or whatever it is. But, you know, that's the way it goes, I guess, right?
It's called the long list now. It's just a long list.
People have to speak up. Otherwise, you know, I don't know. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All righty. We'll take this guest, and then we'll go on to our next segment. Jack from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Lutrice?
Yes.
I truly appreciate your program on 78.
Thank you.
I am white. I happen to be Jewish and a Holocaust survivor. And the reason I'm calling you is I was thinking about this year with the Holocaust. I hear always comparing it to people, other people getting killed. And it's true. What's the difference under what name you getting killed if you get killed? But I would like to, I think, correct you on one idea about the Holocaust as a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
I had no right to exist. I couldn't become a slave. I couldn't go to Africa, to another country, because his ideology was the Jewish race has to be just taken out completely. You had no right whatsoever. Okay? And I think that is a big difference. I couldn't convert. I couldn't go to Africa. I couldn't do any place. The only place I can be is get killed. And I was born in 36, so I was like 7, 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a question of luck where I was at what particular time that I survived and build a new life here and being sorry what I see. And on that speech, I'll just leave it alone because I'm a little excited. You know, I'm not usually that.
You're doing fine.
I appreciate it. Now, and I look at this, I see, you know, I am 78, and the idea of death is starting to come in my conversation, in my thought processes. So I start thinking, I came into this world without nobody asked me to, invited me to this world, and nobody's going to invite me to go out of this world. Civilizations are born, civilizations die. But there's always a potential. So I look around, what kind of miracles happened here that we're not going to go into this massive killing nuclear phase? And I see two miracles. The Berlin Wall came down without major killing. The Russians disintegrated. Whatever became, I don't know, we'll see in the future, it disintegrated. We are seeing a process of disintegration where we live now here. And the way I see it, it's only going to be in the financial markets. We owe too much money, and we play this, what do you call it, baccarat game, one-upmanship, and sooner or later, this is when we lose the power of money, and we take out these people in between and bring in, and that's what evolution is all about, okay? This is just from somebody who's 78, but I would want to leave this audience too. Don't buy anything that you don't need. Go in the supermarkets and watch the baskets, what people buy. They buy stuff that 70% of it they can do themselves. And this is how we survived after the war, when I came out of hiding and when we came to the United States. Also, don't forget Latrice. I came here in December. I turned 13. I started first grade. Never went to school. And at 18 and a half, out of Washington Irving High School, it was a girls' school. I graduated high school from, from night school. Anyways, I can't listen to this man because this is all public relationship, but it doesn't win. And the only thing that I would suggest to the audience, look at oneself and see on the smallest thing what we can do to survive. But thank you for your program. It's
and
always
thank
wonderful.
You for calling.
And it's wonderful to listen to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jack, from Manhattan. Well, that brings us to the end of that segment. I do want to say, though, that we will be dealing. This is a very important question because it incorporates so much in terms of history and the evolution of a people. We have to take another look, I think, at the Holocaust. At the, you know, I remember once asking Elie Wiesel, when I was doing an interview with him on Channel 13, whether he would have regarded the extermination of African Americans and of Africans in America, I should say correctly, and of First Nations people. And he said, no, he didn't consider that a Holocaust. And so we will deal with that question, I think. It's a very important question that Jack has raised. We'll deal with that. But now let's go to Detroit. Thank you, Abayomi, for standing by.
Well, Abayomi Ezekwe is with us.
He's our correspondent, as it were, from Detroit. He's been keeping his fingers on the pulse of Detroit at the moment. And what is happening now as April 1st comes along? Why is that date significant?
Well, April 1st is a date that for one of the objections to be filed on the disclosure statement, that is a deadline set by the court. The plan of adjustment, which is also a part of the bankruptcy proceedings, that is set for April the 28th, but we wanted people to have their objections in by April the 1st, and people have been sending in objections to this plan of adjustment, which is disastrous for the retirees, for the workers of the city of Detroit, and for the residents of the city, because it starves the pension funds, it cuts by at least one-third recipients of the general pension fund and a lesser amount for the police and fire. And there are other aspects of this report which are going to be absolutely devastating for the people of the city. So we want people to come out on April 1st to the federal courthouse and to demonstrate their opposition to Kevin Orr's so-called plan of adjustment. That we're asking people to continue to file objections. A number of people will be filing them on April the 1st with the bankruptcy court in front of the federal courthouse in Detroit on Lafayette Boulevard downtown. And then they're also going to be organizing an election. Ballots, I believe, are going out on April the 28th for an election of all these so-called creditors, which will include retirees and others. To vote on whether or not to accept this plan of adjustment. And we're encouraging people to vote no. There's no benefit for the retirees, for the workers, or anyone else considered a creditor to vote in favor of this plan of adjustment. And there's going to be a lot of opposition, not only from our side, but also from the side of the bond insurers and other corporate creditors as well, who feel that the pensioners should get even less, and that they should get even more. So that's where things stand right now, and it's really sharpening here in the city.
Kevin Orr was at the University of Michigan on Tuesday, and he seemed pretty confident that the court would approve the cuts of pensions by as much as 33%.
Yes, well, we'll see what happens. You know, that's his public relations posture. He's acted in that manner since he's been in Detroit now for over a year. But he has admitted on more than one occasion that he did not anticipate the type of opposition that he'd be getting. And he's going to get even more opposition from many more people because what he's doing has victimized tens of thousands of people. Retirees had their health care benefits cut on March the 1st, and there's going to be other problems associated with the possible efforts to sell the water department, to privatize other aspects of city services. So it's not going to be something that's favorable to the majority of the people of the city of Detroit, and that's why we're advocating that people vote no on this plan of adjustment.
Well, the city is planning to shut off water supplies to between 1,500 and 3,000 customers a week for being delinquent in their bills. We have the city itself being unable. I don't know if you've heard anything different, but by the last court date, he should have, when he said that he had brokered a deal with the banks that they were going to accept, it appears that, in fact, no such deal has been brokered. Do you hear anything different?
Well, they claimed, if you're in reference to the interest rate swap deal with Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and UBS, they were claiming that they had agreed to accept $85 million. This was supposed to be a hearing scheduled on April the 3rd before Judge Rhodes to take up this issue. But the banks have also said that they are willing to sue the city of Detroit if they don't get the $85 million. So it remains to be seen if there's a real deal. And the judge said on January the 16th that they had solid legal ground to pursue damages against both Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, as well as UBS for this deal. And he turned it down flat. The previous deal, which was about $165 million, which came down from the first proposed deal, which was over $240 million or $280 million. But we're going to oppose that as well on April 3rd. So, you know, we're totally against what these people are trying to do. It's an effort to bulldoze the retirees, bulldoze the citizens and residents of the city of Detroit. They have been saying in the corporate media that if the workers and the retirees and the residents don't accept this deal, it's going to be hell to pay, so on and so forth. But I don't think people are going to be that intimidated by or because there are many forms of resistance and opposition, both in the courts and outside the courts, that are taking place in the city.
Abayomi, this is occurring in a really interesting time because this is the year of midterm elections.
Yeah.
And the city manager essentially also controls the political pulse of the city right now because the mayor, in effect, is just there for decoration. He has no real power. A city council also is there for decoration. They don't have any real power. So that the same person who is seeing to the bankruptcy of Detroit is also controlling the political pace at which the city proceeds. What is happening with the questions, the constitutional questions and the legal questions raised around the fact that the city manager, in effect, represents a usurpation of political power and the will of people and the rights of their vote?
Well, both the ruling on the eligibility of the city of Detroit for bankruptcy, which the residents did not file, neither did the mayor or the city council file. It was Kevin Orr, who was appointed by Governor Rick Snyder, an unelected czar, more or less, filed for bankruptcy in order to, in an attempt to subvert the mounds of litigation that was filed against what he wanted to carry out, against the unions, against retirees, and against other forces within the city. But he is not acting in a democratic fashion. And to say that he's controlling the political atmosphere in the city means that we're under a complete dictatorship. And Governor Snyder is going to be standing for re-election in November. And if you look objectively at the conditions here in the state of Michigan, the roads are in abysmal state. There's massive unemployment still, and there's a lot of discontent with the way in which the school systems and systems of governance are operating in Michigan. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in these upcoming elections. There was a report issued by the Municipal League of Michigan, a research study, just a week and a half ago that indicated that the state of Michigan, not only under Governor Snyder, but even the previous administration of Jennifer Granholm, who was a liberal Democrat, has withheld $6.2 billion from the cities in the state of Michigan. I mean, this is atrocious that over $6 billion have been withheld from the municipalities, and yet the municipalities have been forced to lay off employees, to cut back on city services, to not repair the roads, not repair public lighting, other infrastructural problems. We have massive water main breaks here in the city when billions of dollars have been collected in water revenue, because if you don't pay your water bill, they tack it onto your taxes. But the fact of the matter is a lot of the buildings in the city are abandoned because of foreclosure, and in many instances, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department does not cut off the water. So the water is still on in many of these facilities, even though there's no one living there. So when they say they're going to cut off the water to thousands of people in the city of Detroit, it's really going to create an even worse crisis. And this is probably what they want to do, to force even more people out of the city, because you cannot live in a house where there's no running water or utilities. It's almost impossible.
So in this time when Kevin Orr, the emergency city manager, is making practically all the decisions, a lot of decisions are being made around who gets what parcels of land and yes. which land would be up for sale. So that should normally be the decision, should it not, of the city council and the local legislative body. Who is actually making those decisions about land sales and real estate sales?
It's the banks. It's the large-scale corporations. For example, Quicken Loans, which is controlled by Dan Gilbert. They turned over 40 buildings to him in downtown Detroit for essentially nothing. And he's brought a lot of his employees into downtown. And they are dominating the commercial life downtown at this point. Then you got Carmanos, and of course the people at CompuWare. You have Illich, who is the owner of the Detroit Red Wings as well as the Detroit Tigers, who has been given land free in downtown Detroit. Also the assistance of public money to build a new hockey arena, a new hockey arena downtown, when the city is supposed to be in bankruptcy and retirees have had their health care cut by an emergency manager. So this is going on. The decisions are being made by the corporations. They impose their will on the mayor, on the city council. They buy the mayor. They buy the city council to vote on the part of the Detroit City Council on whether or not to award this land and these other public resources to Illich to build this new hockey arena and this new entertainment district in downtown Detroit. It was 6-3 in favor. Only 3 council people out of 9 voted against it. So they are dominating even the political decisions that are being made. And everybody from the community who came up and spoke at the city council were against this massive giveaway. Even the people who lived in the neighborhood of where this thing is going to be built. And some of them are new people to the city, younger, many of them are white, who have moved into that area downtown, and they themselves now are being forced out. And they're bringing in a whole new layer of more corporate-oriented whites to live in the apartments and townhouses and lofts that exist downtown and the ones that they're constructing right now. So it's a massive relocation that's going on, and it's all being dictated by the Dan Gilbert and the Elders and the Kamanos and the Penskys and the others, the Ford family. These are the people who are really calling the shots in Detroit.
Well, thank you so much, Abayomi, for bringing us up to date. We'll, of course, check back as April 1st, which is right around the corner, so comes even closer, and we will know the degree to which there will be some kind of a challenge to the city's plan in the court. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
All right, Abayomi. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope there was value in it for you. If you wish at some point to access that speech by the president and see what it is that we were talking about today, and just it's very important to you know decipher these speeches because they carry all these subtle and not so subtle messages that even the speaker, because sometimes these speeches are written for the president by somebody who probably is quite unacquainted with the irony of many of the statements the president made yesterday. So tomorrow is Free Your Mind Friday, and I hope we do just that. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Occupied Territory, America, with Mike Fader. Drop me a line and let me know what you're thinking at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Thanks. See you tomorrow.